is Pakistan on the one hand, and the problems it shares with India. So if India has to wants to become a more influential country, it needs to cooperate with the region's countries. Now, of course, it also has problems with China, and so it needs to further its clout on the economic level with countries in Asia. And Iran happens to be very well located at the geographic level. So naturally, India will have to pick up or increase its relations with Iran.
Now, Mr. Sharara, how does the West view this visit by the Iranian foreign minister to India and its implications and its tensions over their stance on Ukraine?
Okay, as far as the West goes, of course, they're not in favor of India picking up with relations with Iran. Of course, it's not within their interests. They want an isolated Iran, and they don't want India having anything to do with it. However, look, if you go back to recent history, relations between India with Iran have been very formal. There hasn't been a lot of follow through, even though both countries have signed many, many agreements with one another. So if you look at this recent history, you realize that that this follow through is a lot of it is because of U.S. pressure or because many Indian companies are afraid of the possibility of sanctions. So, okay, they're up to signing agreements with Iran so that they can secure a possible future. But the fear of sanctions has them keeping a step behind, so to speak. So the West naturally doesn't look favorably upon any improvement in relations between Iran and India.
Now, Mr. Sharara, you've mentioned the sanctions. Now, will sanctions affect the extent of trade and economic development? Or does this willingness to expand ties signal another blow to U.S. and EU attempts at controlling the global market?
Okay, as far as sanctions go, as I just said, there's a lot of fear of sanctions from India, and this has kept both countries from taking their ties up to a new level. When you have so many agreements that haven't been implemented, with Indian companies afraid of investing in the Iranian market for fear of U.S. sanctions, this shows you how the impact of the sanctions has been an impediment. It's been impeding the progress of relations between the two countries. However, the readiness of the fact that Amir Abdullahian has visited India, this in and of itself signifies that India is prepared to overcome some of its problems with the EU and the or some of the implications that this may cause with the EU and the US, because as I said, the US and the EU are currently preoccupied with Ukraine. And also, India has to reinforce its Asian depth, its Asian identity. Of course, India is a huge market for the West, and the West needs it more than India needs the West, first of all. Second of all, after the problems that have happened with Ukraine and the fact that India was prepared to stand up to the West in order to secure or keep its relations secure with Russia and to a larger extent with its neighbors in Central Asia, this shows that we're now seeing, hopefully, what can be the beginning of a restructuring in Indian foreign policy. Hopefully, unless the West is able to exert additional pressure in order to keep India from doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Sharara, for being on the program. Now, let's see what people had to say on social media.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi hails the centuries-old civilizational links between India and Iran and notes that relations between the two countries have promoted regional security and prosperity. Dr. S. Jaishankar, India's foreign minister, following his meeting with Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says Both sides reviewed bilateral cooperation, including in trade, connectivity, health, and people-to-people ties. Financial securities analyst Sanjeev Basin points to growing cooperation between Iran and India by citing the report about first transfer of Russian goods to India through a new trade corridor that transits Iran.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Offensive remarks made by two BJP officials about the Prophet of Islam and the inevitable wrath of Muslims seems to threaten India's political and economic ties with Muslim countries, a real risk that could prove detrimental to its economic ties with key trade partners and the main energy supplies for the nation. Shortly after their insults, BJP national spokesperson Nupur Sharma and Naveen Kumar Jindal, who is the chief of the party's media cell, apologized for their comments. Nupur Sharma was suspended and Naveen Kumar was expelled from the party. But the wrath of the Muslim community, which has been facing discrimination and hate campaigns for years, led to violent protests across the country.
Offensive remarks by Nupur Sharma, BJP's national spokesperson, during a televised debate and Naveen Jindal's controversial social media post on religious values were followed by worldwide condemnation by Muslims. India witnessed unprecedented public outcry. From East to West Asia, the Persian Gulf and Northern Africa, India's ambassadors were summoned and official statements were issued by various countries condemning the acts of sacrilege and requesting decisive action by the Indian government. The Organization for Islamic Cooperation said in a statement, "These cases of defamation are part of a growing spate of hatred and defamation of Islam in India and systematic practices against Indian Muslims, particularly in light of a set of decisions to prohibit the use of hijab in educational institutions in some Indian states, including demolition of Muslims' properties and growing violence against them." Later, the Indian Foreign Ministry released a statement rejecting the offensive comments and tweets, stressing that these are the views of individuals and do not represent the values of the Indian government. But all the efforts made by BJP officials failed to suppress the public outcry of Muslims and stop nationwide protests. Thousands of Muslims in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other Muslim countries took to the streets to protest. The protests led to violence in India, leaving few dead and dozens injured, adding to India's long history of anti-Islam sentiments. Thousands of commentators had predicted that the pressure would lead to Muslims' reprisals, which can lead to a new series of ethnic and religious tensions.
The founders of a free India, including Jawaharlal Nehru, made the right decision to create a secular state, and one of the reasons for the decision was to accommodate the plethora of ethnic and religious identities in the nation. But since the BJP came into power, discriminatory and extremist policies implemented against Muslims have created a tense atmosphere in the country. Despite the emphasis of the Indian constitution on its secular nature, pressures against the Muslim minority seem to be intensifying as of late. They started with the implementation of extremist regulations against religious minorities, but have led to beating and even killing of Muslims and the demolition of the houses by extremists.
Muslims form 13% of India's total population. This 200 million strong population that has peacefully coexisted with other religious communities has become alienated from the rest of the nation following British colonialist rule and their policy of divide and conquer. This divide was exacerbated by the rise of the BJP and the party's provoking anti-Muslim sentiments in the public, leading to animosity from the minority Muslim population. Judging by the Babri Mosque case and the annexation of Kashmir's administrative authority, the Indian nationality law increased pressure against women wearing hijab and thousands of small instances of harassment of Muslims, a re-evaluation of the performance of Indian officials when it comes to harassment of minorities seems inevitable. In the recent case of insults against sacred values of Muslims on India's media and social media platforms, the issue has been stretched beyond religious disputes among the nation, becoming a global issue. Analysts believe that the party's reaction to the issue will not be sufficient, and if senior members of the Indian government and its ruling party fail to present an appropriate public response, their ties with other Muslim countries may become undone. 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have demanded decisive action by the Indian government to discipline those who insulted the Prophet. If a $90 billion trade agreement with the Gulf Cooperation Council in 2020 to 2021 is at risk, not to mention the work and livelihood of millions of Indians living in its member states, India will be facing a serious challenge on its path to becoming a global powerhouse, because it will need the energy supply and the export market.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Clifton de Rosario, General Secretary at All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Mr. Rosario, welcome to the program. Now, the protests in response to the derogatory comments against Prophet Muhammad have taken India by storm, but is this backlash unexpected after the continuous harassment of Muslims across the country?
Okay. What we're witnessing right now, in our country is really posing some very crucial questions of our nation in terms of how we go forward from here, what the idea of this country is going to be. And I think, one really shouldn't be too surprised. The Islamophobic statements that were made, the kind of bigotry that we are seeing, the targeting of the Muslims in a sense, which basically is premised on the understanding that Muslims and other minorities, as has always been the case with Dalits, are second-class citizens in this country. That message that is being sought to be drilled into the daily lives of Muslims by state and non-state actors. This, I think, is an extremely challenging time, as it were. And obviously, the Muslim community is not taking this lying down, and they are responding to it. The kind of protest that we saw when the government tried to force down the Citizenship Amendment Act down the throats of people over here.
Mr. Rosario, we know that the Muslim community in India has been discriminated against since the BJP came into power. But after the suspension of anti-Islam political figures, do you think the political pressure is finally working?
The fact that, the BJP national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, and the party's, BJP's Delhi media head, Naveen Kumar Jindal, could so brazenly such vicious Islamophobic statements is something that I think we have to really take note of. It reflects the kind of bigotry that is running amok in our country. In that sense, it was obvious that there was going to be some kind of a public outrage against it, as also some kind of international pressure as well. And no doubt, we saw that, several states, whether it's Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Malaysia, etc., who all came out in strong condemnation of it. And of course, the threat at that point was the boycott of Indian goods. That seemed to have, played a big role in the government that's coming out with the statement that these are fringe elements. And then, of course, expelling them from the party. One really needs to read between the lines over here. How can they be called fringe? In fact, right now, the slogan that is going across the country is that gali gali mein shor hai, fringe nahi ye core hai. That means everybody knows for sure that these so-called fringe are actually the core. So what both of them have said is something that is being said every day in the media. It is being said in the hate speeches, in the Dharam Sansad. It's being said all across the country.
Mr. Razavia, Muslim countries have condemned the many cases of Islamophobia-fueled comments by BJP officials and demanded an appropriate response by the government. So how can the BJP government mend the damage caused by its anti-Islam policies?
I'm just saying that I'm a little surprised at how people are trying to see this. The point is that if you were to look at the situation of the Muslim community in India, and I'd say from an economic sense, and you have the Rajinder Sachar report, which was brought in when the previous UPA was in power, which basically talks about the extremely vulnerable economic situation of the Muslim community. Now, added to that, you have this this virulent attack on the being of the Muslim itself. So whether it's the hijab, whether it's a Muslim street vendor, whether it is COVID, every single context is being communalized. Every single situation is being used for communal polarization. So indeed, you know, this is an extremely, extremely serious situation. But the point is that the pressure that we are talking about comes only at a particular point. Now, from 2014, we have witnessed the lynchings of Muslims. But unfortunately, that did not create that kind of a huge outcry. So the targeting of the Muslims has been happening, you can say, from 2014. It is completely heightened. There's no two ways about it. But there hasn't been any that kind of a corresponding international pressure on the Indian state for it to push back from its agenda. Its core agenda is this, alongside this crony capitalist agenda it's one of its core agenda is anti-minority.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Clifton de Rosario for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people had to say.
Ashok Swain, an academic and analyst, says massive protests have broken out in India, Bangladesh and Pakistan over derogatory remarks about Prophet Muhammad by India's Hindu right-wing regime officials. Pakistan's former human rights minister, Shirin Mazari, asks why is the OIC not calling a special session to deal with the BJP spokesperson's blasphemous remarks and targeting of protesting Muslims. Khalid Beydoun, a law professor and author, calls on the Arab governments to use their power and influence to prevent state terror being unleashed against Indian Muslims.
And that was our episode on the prospects and challenges of economic cooperation between Iran and India and the domestic, regional and global consequences of insulting the Holy Prophet of Islam. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In Britain, human rights campaigners are saying an appalling pilot scheme treats those fleeing conflict and persecution as criminals. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Anna McSwan. The piece is titled People Arriving in UK on Small Boats to be Electronically Tagged. Britain, refugee rights campaigners have described a new Home Office scheme to electronically tag asylum seekers as appalling, saying the move treats people fleeing conflict and persecution as criminals. Under a 12-month pilot scheme, which began on Wednesday, 15th of June, some people arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats or in the back of lorries will be electronically tagged. Critics say the draconian move will do nothing to stop people from taking risky journeys to reach the United Kingdom in search of asylum. Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended the plans on Saturday morning, saying it was essential that people did not simply vanish into the rest of the country. Under the plans, asylum seekers will have to regularly report in person to authorities and may be subject to a curfew or excluded from certain locations, while failure to do so could result in them being returned to detention or prosecuted in courts of law. Enver Solomon, the chief executive of the Refugee Council, said, "It's appalling that this government is intent on treating men, women and children who have fled war, bloodshed and persecution as criminals. This draconian and punitive approach not only shows no compassion for very vulnerable people, it will also do nothing to deter those who are desperately seeking safety in the United Kingdom." The Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking to reporters at RAF Bryce Norton after returning from an unannounced visit to Kiev in Ukraine said, "This is a very, very generous, welcoming country. Quite right too. I'm proud of it. But when people come here illegally, when they break the law, it is important that we make that distinction. That is what we're doing with our Rwanda policy. That is what we're doing with making sure that asylum seekers can't just vanish into the rest of the country." Meanwhile, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, accused the government of chasing headlines. "What I want is a serious response, because nobody wants these journeys across the channel to be made, these perilous journeys," he said during a visit to Wakefield in West Yorkshire. Keir Starmer added, "Everybody wants to clamp down on the gangs. That requires grown-up work with the French authorities and upstream work to actually tackle these gangs. You don't do that if you're a government that is asking the National Crime Agency to make cuts." The Home Office said the trial programme would test whether the electronic monitoring assists in maintaining regular contact with those given bail and helps to progress their claims more effectively. The first people to be tagged under the new scheme were likely to be those who avoided removal to Rwanda this week for processing. It comes after the European Court of Human Rights, the ECHR, granted an injunction on Tuesday that resulted in the cancellation of a chartered flight to Kigali, Rwanda, the capital of Rwanda. Britain's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, accused the European Court of Human Rights of being politically motivated in its absolutely scandalous decision. In an interview with The Telegraph, Priti Patel said, "You've got to look at the motivation. How and why did they make that decision? What is politically motivated? I'm of the view that it is absolutely. The opaque way this court has operated is absolutely scandalous. That needs to be questioned. We don't know who the judges are. We don't know who the panel are. We haven't actually had a judgment, just a press release and a letter saying we can't move this person under Rule 39. They've not used this ruling previously, which does make you question the motivation and the lack of transparency." Britain's Justice Secretary Dominic Raab has suggested that new laws could ensure interim measures from the Strasbourg court could, in effect, be ignored by the government. New figures have revealed that the number of people crossing the channel to reach Britain this year has passed 11,000. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has previously said that a clear majority of people arriving in the United Kingdom by small boat should be considered to be refugees fleeing conflict or persecution. While the Home Secretary Priti Patel told MPs and peers last year that 70% of people making the crossing were single men who are effectively economic migrants, and the government has repeatedly referred to them as migrants, the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says government data challenges this claim. On Thursday, 16th of June, 146 people on four small boats were brought to Britain. The daily number has decreased steadily throughout the week after a high of 444 on Tuesday. That was the highest number since 562 on 14th of April this year. At least 48 people were brought ashore at Dover, Kent, on Thursday.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals that Israel secretly coordinates with the U.S. on many of the airstrikes it carries out in Syria. The report adds that since 2017, Israel has carried out more than 400 airstrikes in Syria and other parts of the West Asia region. It claims that Israeli attacks have been aimed at restricting Iran and its allied forces in Syria. The vast majority of those Israeli airstrikes have been approved by the U.S. Central Command and at the Pentagon. The U.S. aims to ensure that Israel's bombing raids don't interfere with the U.S.-led military campaign in Syria. Many observers believe that the revelation by the Wall Street Journal was rather a confirmation of an open secret policy.
I think, first of all, whenever anyone says that the U.S. is secretly doing this or that with Israel, it's almost naive to say that. Israel is, in essence, an agent of the United States. I know there are people that think it works the other way around. But Israel is a Euro-American white settler state that was imposed on Palestine, as people know. Project beginning, I guess, perhaps you say, from the Balfour Declaration in the 20s forward to when the State of Israel, quote unquote, was created. And it's been a military base, basically, from which to secure the oil fields of the area, Iran's, Iraq's, all of it, Syria's, everywhere. The Israeli military, for all of its public relations effort to the contrary, is an agent of the U.S. military with some nominal French and British input into that. Certainly financial input is not nominal, it's real. But this is a creature of the Pentagon and Langley that behaves in coordination with the policy that is implemented by the United States.
The timing of the Wall Street Journal revelation comes as the Israeli regime has increased its attacks against Syria. Last week, the regime heavily struck Damascus International Airport, which is still not completely up and running. Syrian officials have said on many occasions that U.S. troops in Syria are there to loot the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was not embarrassed to frankly say that he kept U.S. troops in Syria for Syrian oil only.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly. And
the fight against Daesh seems to have been a good pretext to maintain U.S. illegal presence in Syria. Syrian officials have also repeatedly called on the United Nations to stop Israel's strikes on the country. But those calls have almost always gone unnoticed behind a couple of verbal admonitions by UN officials. This seems to have emboldened the regime to carry on its attacks with impunity.
After setting loose Daesh and al-Qaeda and 47 other varieties of jihadi on Syria, the U.S. government found itself facing a request from the Syrian government that had, by the way, been twice elected since 2011 by vast majorities of Syrians inside and outside the country. Israel is, you know, a U.S. lapdog. That has lots of advanced weapons. It's a money laundry for money that goes funneled through the Pentagon and Langley. Billions and billions of dollars of money taken from American taxpayers ends up in the hands of arms merchants, all kinds of people through Israel and whatever. And these things are used to inflict misery on the people of the Middle East to the extent that there's any resistance between these people that want to own the resources of that area and the actual ownership of it.
The confirmations of the U.S. approval and coordinations of Israeli attacks in Syria can definitely be seen as rather a public support for regime strikes in Syria, especially at a time when Israel has increased the intensity of its cross-border attacks. Such support would likely embolden the Israeli regime to carry out more attacks in Syria.
Turkey has targeted northern Iraq, killing several people and injuring a number of others. The strike hit the Sinjar Resisting Units, or YBS, a militia affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Iraq's northern province of Sinjar. Turkey regards the PKK as a terrorist outfit. According to security sources, the strike hit a municipal council building in Sunni, a village near the border with Syria. Turkey regularly carries out airstrikes into northern Iraq and has sent commandos to support its offensives. Baghdad accuses Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has a long-running military campaign in northern Syria against Syrian Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara considers that group as a terrorist organization as well. Ankara is reportedly planning to expand its military operation in northern Syria. President Erdogan has told the parliament Ankara aims to resume its efforts to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria. He has also urged NATO member states to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria.
It is crazy to think that the Turks will be fighting American-sponsored Kurds, and there isn't anybody in the world community that can call them up on the hypocrisy and say, you are fighting amongst yourselves in a way that could end up in a world war.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the international community not to work with Erdogan on the lands of other countries to achieve goals that will have catastrophic effects on security, peace, and stability in the region and in the world. Russia also considers Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise as it could escalate and destabilize the situation. Iran also voiced concern about the planned operation, saying the move could complicate the situation even further. In Syria, Turkey conducted three military operations in 2016, 2018, and 2019 that specifically aimed to prevent the formation of politically autonomous regions along the Turkish border controlled by Kurdish-dominated YPG militants. A fourth operation in 2020 in the Idlib region did not specifically target PKK affiliates, but it was in line with Turkey's desire to maintain territorial control and create a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border.
But it's a big problem. It shows Turkey up for what it is, and that Turkey is doing everything in the region purely for their own short-term benefit, and they are quite happy to fight the Kurds and crush the Kurds, and this completely conflicts with the the Americans aren't really trying to help the Kurds, as they aren't ever really trying to help anyone apart from themselves, and their short-term allies, the Kurds, are going to end up fighting their other allies, the Turks.
Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push YPG fighters away from border areas. Turkey has played a major role in supporting terrorists in Syria ever since a major foreign-backed insurgency overtook the country more than 10 years ago. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other senior officials have said the Damascus government will respond through all legitimate means available to the ongoing ground offensive by Turkish forces and allied Takfiri militants in the northern part of the war-battered Arab country.
Iran is expanding its diplomatic and economic ties with its neighbors and beyond. On Wednesday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hosted his Turkmen counterpart Serdar Berdimuhamedov in Saadabad Palace in northern Tehran. Iran and Turkmenistan signed a set of documents and memoranda of understanding to broaden bilateral cooperation in different fields. 9 MOUs were signed in the meeting to boost cooperation in various fields, including politics, economy, trade, transportation, investment, new technologies, environment, sports, energy, judiciary, education, research, and tourism. This is Berdimuhamedov's first visit to Iran as Turkmenistan's president. He traveled to Tehran in January as the special envoy of Turkmenistan's former president and held talks with Raisi. Iran and Turkmenistan have agreed to set up a major trade center that can facilitate ties between businesses in the two countries amid efforts to deepen economic relations between the two neighbors. The establishment of the Tehran-Ashgabat Trade Center was discussed on Tuesday during a meeting between Iranian Trade Minister Reza Fatemi Amin and Deputy Head of the Cabinet of Ministers of Turkmenistan, Batir Atdayev. On Tuesday, Iran's president hosted visiting Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. During the meeting, Raisi hailed ties between Iran and Pakistan and said Tehran and Islamabad can expand their bilateral trade and business ties to benefit both nations.
I find this most recent flurry of diplomatic activity and state visits to Iran to be highly significant. What this signifies is that clearly Iran, far from being isolated on the world stage, is in fact extending its ties, bilateral ties, both regionally and as well ties to Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere.
And earlier in the week, Iran welcomed Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and his high-level delegation. Iran and Venezuela have signed partnership agreements in the fields of science, technology, agriculture, oil and gas, petrochemicals, tourism, as well as culture. Raisi hailed the accord as an indication of the two countries' determination to expand bilateral ties despite U.S. and Western pressure. And the Venezuelan president, for his part, lauded the 20-year partnership agreement between Tehran and Caracas, saying the two sides will be able to expand bilateral relationship by consolidating their ties and drawing a clear vision in the next two decades.
as far as the outcome of these visits, this can only be positive for these nations, for most recently Pakistan, whose prime minister visited, for the Turkmen president, and as well for President Maduro. Those nations and national leadership that seeks to maintain sovereignty and independence, especially and particularly from American global economic and military hegemony, will greatly benefit their national economies as well as their populations.
And last month, Iran hosted Tajikistan's President Emomali Rahman. That visit also resulted in the signing of major deals between Tehran and Dushanbe. Since the inauguration of President Raisi's government, Tehran has stressed on the expansion of ties with regional as well as non-regional countries. Raisi's major achievement was his attendance at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Dushanbe, where Iran was formally accepted as a new member of the organization. Iran's accession to the SCO will be a major boost to the bloc's influence in the region.
I believe what we're seeing is the relatively exciting and promising, although challenging, beginnings of the complete break from the dollar-based global economic system. I say exciting and promising because this will definitely enable nations that seek to maintain their independence and sovereignty to break from the dollar-based global economic system. However, this is certainly not an easy task and one that comes without costs.
Mainly because Iran's massive transportation network can facilitate regional and international trade. Iran is also expected to benefit economically from the membership in the bloc. The Iranian Customs Office said that Iranian exports to SCO members had increased by 41% year-on-year in the 11 months to late February, reaching nearly $18.3 billion.
But ultimately, we can look forward to the development of actual systems and structures that will enable nations, independent sovereign nations such as Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, potentially other nations in the region who want to get on board, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, which we were recently talking about, to move towards a system that is not reliant, for example, on SWIFT and that completely bypasses the dollar.
Earlier this year, Iran's president also visited Russia to expand bilateral ties. Tehran and Moscow reached agreements to expand their cooperation in the fields of industry, defense and aerospace sectors, as well as oil and energy. The burgeoning ties between Iran and other countries have foiled plots by the US and its allies to isolate Iran. They also show that sanctions and threats have failed to stop Iran's progress.
After some three decades of a fall in the global stockpile of nuclear weapons, the world seems to be on the brink of witnessing a reverse in the declining trend. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's yearly report states that online possessors of nuclear weapons, namely the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, continue to modernize their nuclear arsenals. The arms watchdog, also known as CIPRI, says the total number of nuclear weapons declined slightly between January 2021 and January 2022. However, a senior associate with the think tank says there is evidence of change in where the world is headed and warned that this is a very worrying trend. The trend in nuclear weapons worldwide has been witnessing a declining trend for a long time. It is now lower than one-fifth of what it was within the arsenals of the nuclear powers at the top of the Cold War in the 1980s. And now, CIPRI's report comes at the height of mixed signals regarding nuclear diplomacy. Earlier this year, the five UN veto powers, including China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, declared their intention to take action against the further spread of nuclear weapons. but the think tank asserted that all five countries had since further expanded or modernized their arsenals.
The United States has attempted to take control as a unipolar power, and it's been a calamity for around the world, actually, for so many countries in so many ways. And for the last two decades, they've been driving forward. They have abandoned the nuclear treaties that were hammered out over the last part of the 20th century.
CIPRI reports that Russia and the U.S. possess about 90% of all nuclear warheads in the world, while the watchdog says the number of nuclear warheads in both countries fell in 2021. It states that the decline was mainly due to dismantling of those which the military had already abandoned years ago. CIPRI says that out of the total number of global nuclear warheads, an estimated 3,732 were deployed with missiles and aircrafts, and around 2,000 were kept in a state of high readiness, nearly all of which belong to either Russia or the United States. The Russian military doctrine allows the battlefield use of nuclear weapons, and the Biden administration has discussed possible responses. But who is following the path of war more, risking the use of nuclear weapons?
The United States is definitely driving this process. They're driving NATO ever closer to Russia. And I think that when you say the U.S. and its allies, you have to realize that Russia has allies as well. And those alliances are being strengthened by the U.S. aggression that's happening right now. U.S. aggression in the Middle East has driven Syria and some other country, and Turkey, actually, who are not getting along with each other, but they're both being driven more into Russia and China's orbit and out of the U.S. economic center. And now with NATO pressing up against the borders of Russia, I mean, it's truly a terrible thing to do, and not to acknowledge that anyone has interests except the United States. So, of course, Russia's going to defend their borders.
Meanwhile, as the West proceeds with its acts of aggression across the globe, it has also ramped up its rhetoric against Iran. This comes as one of the U.S.'s closest allies, Israel, which also possesses nuclear weapons, has made threats against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett claimed that Tehran was drawing dangerously close to producing nuclear weapons. The accusation comes despite Tehran's strong rejection of producing or even considering nuclear weapons. Bennett also called on the global community to ramp up efforts against Tehran, saying Iran's nuclear program won't stop until stopped. The warmongering aspirations of the U.S. and its allies comes while the world seems to be faced with many other challenges. Relations across the globe seem to have deteriorated further at the time when humanity and the planet face an array of profound and pressing common challenges. And while such difficulties could only be addressed by international cooperation, many, including the U.S., seem to be more focused on aggressive policies.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For the first time in 20 years, a newly elected French president has failed to win an absolute majority in parliament, forcing President Emmanuel Macron of France to deal with a defiant left and a resurgent far right. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Aurélien Bredin and Constant Mahout. The piece is titled, Macron Loses Absolute Majority as Opposition Surges, a Blow for New Term. Voters in France's legislative elections dealt President Emmanuel Macron a serious blow on Sunday, 19th of June, as his centrist coalition lost its absolute majority in the lower house of the French Parliament to a resurgent far-right and a defiant alliance of left-wing parties, complicating his domestic agenda for his second term in office. With all votes counted, Emmanuel Macron's centrist coalition won 245 seats in the 577-seat National Assembly, the lower and more powerful house of the French Parliament. That was more than any other political group, but less than half of all the seats, and far less than the 350 seats that Mr. Macron's party and its allies won when he was first elected back in 2017. For the first time in 20 years, a newly elected president failed to muster an absolute majority in the French National Assembly. It will not grind Mr. Macron's domestic agenda to a complete halt, but will likely throw a large wrench into his ability to get bills passed. Shifting power back to Parliament after a first term in which his top-down style of governing has mostly marginalised lawmakers. Emmanuel Macron's government will likely have to seek a coalition or build short-term alliances on bills, but it was unclear on Sunday night how it might go about doing so. The results were a sharp warning from French voters to Emmanuel Macron, who just months ago convincingly won re-election against Marine Le Pen, the far-right leader. The slap was Monday's headline on the front page of the left-leaning daily Libération. Elisabeth Borne, Emmanuel Macron's prime minister, who won her own race in Normandy, said on Sunday, 19th of June, that the results were unprecedented and that this situation constitutes a risk for our country given the challenges that we must face. Starting tomorrow, we will work on building a majority of action, she said, suggesting, without giving details, that the government would work with other political parties to build good compromises. President Emmanuel Macron appeared disengaged from the parliamentary elections and did little campaigning himself, seeming more preoccupied by France's diplomatic efforts to support Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, which Sunday's results should not impact, as French presidents can conduct foreign policy mostly as they please. Speaking on an airport tarmac before a trip to Eastern Europe that took him to Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, this past week, he had urged voters to give him a solid majority in the superior interest of the nation. But many French voters chose instead to either stay at home, only about 46% of the French electorate went to the ballot box, according to projections, the second lowest participation level since 1958. Or to vote for Mr. Macron's most radical opponents. Several of Emmanuel Macron's close allies or cabinet members who were running in the election lost their races, a stinging rebuke for the president, who had vowed that ministers who failed to win a seat would have to resign. Richard Ferrand, the president of the National Assembly, and Amélie de Montchalin, his minister for green transition, were both defeated. "We disappointed a certain number of French people. The message is clear," Olivier Grégoire, a spokesman for Emmanuel Macron's government, told France 2 television on Sunday. "It's a disappointing first place, but it's a first place nonetheless," she said, adding that Emmanuel Macron's coalition would work in Parliament with all those who want to move the country forward. Final results gave the alliance of left-wing parties, which includes the Hard Left, France Unbound Party, the Socialists, the Greens and Communists, and is led by the leftist veteran Jean-Luc Mélenchon, 131 seats, making it the biggest opposition force in the French National Assembly. The national rally of Marine Le Pen's far-right party secured 89 seats, a historic record. Etienne Orlion, a socialist teaching at École Polytechnique, said Sunday's results were a double surprise. It's the absence of an absolute majority. We saw it coming, but did not expect it to be at that level. And on the other hand, it's the strong breakthrough of the national rally, which is quite spectacular, he said. With a slim relative majority, the smallest in France's 63-year-old Fifth Republic, according to Etienne Orlion, and a strong opposition on the left and on the far right, Emmanuel Macron's centrist coalition could struggle to pass bills, potentially forcing him to reach across the aisle to opposing lawmakers on some votes. The way the president will be able to govern through his prime minister is rather uncertain at the moment, Etienne Orlion said. It was not immediately clear what other allies Emmanuel Macron's coalition might find to form a working majority, although it seemed that the most likely fit would be Les Républicains, the mainstream conservative party, which won 61 seats. Mr. Macron will also be much more dependent on his centrist allies than he was during his first term in office, especially to pass contentious projects like his plan to raise the legal age of retirement to 65 from 62. That could give more leverage to parties like Horizons, a centre-right group founded by Mr. Macron's former Prime Minister Edouard Philippe, who is more of a fiscal hawk. Horizons is expected to win about 25 seats. We are used to seeing France's system as centred on the presidency, because it is the most powerful political office in the country, said Olivier Rosenberg, an associate professor at Sciences Po in Paris. But these legislative elections remind us that our political system is also a parliamentary one at heart. Jean-Luc Mélenchon and Marine Le Pen both said on Sunday that they had succeeded in disrupting Emmanuel Macron's second term. The presidential party's defeat is complete, Jean-Luc Mélenchon told cheering supporters in Paris. We reached the political objective that we had set for ourselves. Mr. Mélenchon failed to achieve his initial goal, which was to seize control of the National Assembly and force Emmanuel Macron to appoint him as Prime Minister. Major policy differences among coalition members on issues like the European Union could also resurface once the lower house of the French Parliament reconvenes later this month. Still, it was a strong showing for left-wing parties that had been largely written off as hopelessly divided during the presidential elections. At the other end of the political spectrum, Marine Le Pen's national rally won many more seats than the handful it has now, and far more than was expected after Marine Le Pen was defeated by Emmanuel Macron in the presidential election in April, and then ran a lackluster campaign for the parliamentary election. Ms. Le Pen herself was handily re-elected to her seat in a district in northern France. This group will be by far the largest in the history of our political family, she said in a speech on Sunday, 19th of June, promising her supporters that she would defend the party's hard line on issues like immigration and security. Emmanuel Macron's predicament is not unique in modern French history. In 1988, under President François Mitterrand, the Socialist Party was also unable to muster an absolute majority in the National Assembly, forcing it to occasionally poach lawmakers on the left or on the right to pass bills. But that government also had access to tools, like the ability to force a bill through without a ballot by exposing the government to a confidence vote, that are now far more restricted.